Hello?
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 This is Tracy. Are we on our call?
Well, we're waiting for Dave.
Okay. Perfect.
This is Rose. I'm here, too. Okay.
Oh, nice.
Hi.
Hi, Rose.
What's going on with it?
Turn off in 1 second.
Oh, it's in the
game.
The dog kicked it and started it.
Can I unmute or no?
I can't mute it until he gets on.
Well, hey, everybody, and welcome. Some of you may have seen my email today, an hour or so before this time, that I would like to extend, if you're interested, a 10 or 15-minute time at the end of our seminar, our final seminar today, at the top of the hour to do discussion, question and answer. I'm eager to hear from you. And I want to remind again, to because of the number of people, to manage the background noise, do a star six until you're ready to talk. First, again, I want to say how much I appreciate your responses, the questions. Again, manage the background noise, please. Even if you clear your throat, it's picked up by your microphone, even though you may not hear it. Especially this will be important for a discussion time at the end, because I'd like to keep an open mic. So there are a number of questions and responses that I've had, and in reviewing the answers to the two initial questions that each of you has sent in, there's going to be a bit of departure, more so than usual, from the outline to incorporate some of the things that you've asked. I think they're very pertinent questions. They're all obviously from people who have a good deal of experience and inquisitiveness about becoming better mentor coaches, which is why we're doing this after all. So I will incorporate some of that in the seminar this evening, but first a comment, and then I want to ask for any responses. And this is in reviewing and reflecting on the questions that you ask initially to kind of frame this. Remember, when we work with our clients, that we don't primarily train or educate or inform. And when we talk about in our work and collaboration, understanding their stories, their life or money or wellness or relationship or career story, that for them, it's not a story. That's the way things are. That's reality. It's our metaphor to give us a way of better understanding and conceptualizing, because story is a way that we remember and perceive and make sense of things, the way that we can describe what we do. Even each individual coaching session is a story in and of itself. And the three components of story, the challenge, the development, the resolution, are there in each coaching session that we do, as well as the overall coaching engagement. So it's simply a way that we can think about things that can help us make more sense and have a configuration that will allow us to discuss it more meaningfully. So comments, questions, things that would be helpful initially to talk about, and remember, we'll have an additional 10 or 15 minutes at the end if you'd like to hang around and just have a discussion. So what would be...
Dave, will a Q&A be recorded also?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. All of these are recorded. They're available at the same link that you were given when you registered, are the ones I sent. The one I sent around as a reminder, where you did the download of the outline. All four ports there are for the four seminars. The one for this day will be recorded within 24 hours. They will all be available for about 30 days beyond our last seminar, which is today. So thanks for... Oh, and there are four credits for continuing education through ICF. Contact Bernadette, CoachTrainingAlliance.com. So thanks for that reminder. What else would be helpful to discuss at the beginning?
Dave, this is Ellen.
Yeah, hey.
Happy to be on call. I had a note from last week, and I'm sorry if this is redundant. The last little section we talked about, the Darren Brown study and what is your yellow chalk circle, I clearly missed this, so I just wanted to kind of check in about that.
Okay, well, that's because I didn't add it last time. I was going to add it as a discussion this time, but it's
great.
Okay, well, good. Yeah, it's
that's perfect.
Okay. Yeah, it's an interesting study that I think could be helpful for us to think about. So, yeah, I will definitely add that in.
Okay.
Thanks for the reminder. Other sure. other questions or comments?
Quickly, this is Shannon. You mentioned the creation of new brain cells for the hippocampus, and exercise is one of the ways to increase that. Is there a minimum, or what does that look like?
There are different studies on that, but it's basically regular exercise on a daily, almost daily basis, 5 to 6 days a week. Here's what there's an excellent book on this, and this is where the study came from. Henry Lodge Jr. is an internist in New York City. Actually, he died fairly recently, but who devoted 35 years of his professional life to wellness research. And he has a book that I would highly recommend. I recommend this to all the wellness coaches I've trained, called Younger Next Year. And the companion book for women is Younger Next Year for Women. And in that book, in his studies, he recommends that we work out a minimum of 6 times a week, 4 of those cardiovascular. And from the age at least of 50 on, but earlier if possible, in order to live longer, live healthier, and to really have the benefits of regular workouts. I collaborated with him. We participated in a presentation. I'd been working out 3 or 4 times a week, and then after that, and after we collaborated, I began working out 6 days a week. It made a huge difference, just in terms of energy level. And if you treat it, and this is what he emphasizes, that it's not something we find time for or that we do when we've kind of run out of other things to do or get bored, but that it, like we've been talking about in terms of if you want to create change or change a habit or create a new habit, create a system. What he recommends is that exercise be treated like work, which is to say to create a system. Because think about, at least in pre-COVID days, you get up, you go to work. You don't debate about it. You don't decide that, well, I'm going to, you know, just knock off this week, but I'm really going to get going starting next Tuesday. Or you don't feel virtuous if you do it. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you do it. It's part of a structure of a system. Same way with working out. You guys know central time where I'm going to be 2 o'clock every day. I don't schedule anything else because that's the one thing that I schedule at 2 o'clock every day, 6 days a week. That's it. That's the way I believe you have to do it, the way he recommends in terms of making it a priority, because it will make a major difference for the rest of your life. So I'm glad you asked that and that you got my take off and riff on that, which you may not have deserved, but I hope it's helpful. Does that make sense in terms of a response to your question, more than you ask even?
Yes, it does. Thank you very
okay,
much.
Good.
And
good,
also
okay.
Inspiring and in ways going into the holidays that are helpful.
Yeah, yeah, especially. So after that, does anybody else dare ask a question? If not, final call. Again, we'll have some time for discussion at the end. I'll put us on lecture mode. And again, I'm going to depart. It may sound like I'm sort of moving around, which I am, because there are some things based on some of the questions you asked that I want to be sure and cover, and they relate to basically what I had planned to talk about, but may or may not be in your outline, and there may be some things, especially the things that may be self-explanatory in the outline, I won't go over. So hold on. Okay, we're going to talk about updating your operating system, about essentially writing new stories. First, the brain's story of self. Brain imaging studies have demonstrated that there actually is a location in the brain for our sense of self. It's the medial prefrontal cortex. This part of the brain lights up when people self-reflect, when they make assessments and judgments regarding themselves. And think about some self-reflection prompts. Listen for the story that the source within you tells. Tell your story the way you want it to be in order to actualize it. Plan it, map it, tell it, then initiate its creation. Whatever you're living or experiencing in any way is in response to the story you're telling. If you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell the story so that it shifts your feeling and thinking as you're telling it. Remember, beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So we have to really address the belief system that is directing our story. And this new telling or any changes that you make has to align with who you are, especially your needs and ideals, but it has to incorporate at least a revision of your operating system, mainly your identity. So let's think about that in a sense. What does it mean that a large part of your adult life you've been a true fan of a team? Now, forget about you may not be a sports fan, but think about any team that you've been a true fan of. Let's say it is a sports team. Let's say it's the Boston Patriots. Now, over time, you grew up in Boston, you've been a fan. Over time, every football player on that team has changed. Every coach. The stadium. So what is it you're really a fan of? Because the whole thing has changed. Where it began a long time ago, it doesn't even resemble it right now. Same for car brands. What are you a fan of? I've driven the same kind of car since, I'll admit it, 1977. Every time I get in, I don't have to think about it anymore. It's like the George Costanza statement. I like things I don't have to think about because it's part of an identity. So think about an identity as a sense of self and community. Well, people like us do things like this. So we create beliefs and suspend disbelief to fit that identity. That's how we make decisions. And I correspond with a couple of neuroeconomics labs, and this is something that we know now. If you take a large group of people, small to a large group of people, and put 10 items in front of them and instruct them or direct them to purchase one of those, if you hook them up with an fMRI scanner and they look at each sequentially, you can, in a high 90% degree probability, you can predict what they're going to select. This is something we do in neuromarketing. You can predict what they're going to select because it's the one thing that they identify with. We purchase what we identify with. We do what we identify with. We become a fan of what. So this is the importance, and I'm emphasizing this, because this is something you have to address with your clients, because when they have done something over and over, it becomes part of who they are. It's their identity. This is the final step of change or transformation with a client, is to incorporate the change and the transformation into their operating system. This is the 90 to 95%, remember, that we talked about how we really make decisions. So unless change is incorporated in someone's identity, then they'll revert back to their behavior before. So this is something in doing mentor coaching with clients, this is something I believe that can be consistently addressed to reflect on and observe how the client is changing and transforming, which also is a model that they're downloading so that they can reflect on their own change and transformation. And ultimately, that model is downloaded so it becomes self-functioning, so that they don't need us to do it. It becomes who they are to self-reflect and address their own development and the evolution and transformation of their development. So this is something I believe that probably is the most important thing that we can do with our clients, is to address this process of self-reflection, which includes self-empathy, and addressing this so that the client incorporates this to be able to facilitate that themselves. And when they do, then they don't need us anymore, because there are things that will come up that neither you nor your client could ever predict, but they'll be able to handle. Now, you'll be there as a consultant, a single time in the future. I say to clients, I'll be your coach for life. Now, there's only going to be a certain very finite period that we'll need to work together in this way, but I'll be available. So that's the kind of thing that you may think about facilitating from the very beginning. So let's look at some aspects of this. One is commitment and pre-commitment. Pre-commitment is something to consider. In the Odyssey, and you guys know this story, Odysseus and his men were sailing home from the Trojan War. He'd been warned about the sirens, whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wants to hear it anyhow. So he does a couple of things. He gives his men earplugs and gives them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore all pleas for release until they're past the danger. Now, this is management of desire, and it invents pre-commitment to inoculate himself against his predictable and potentially fatal future desire. Now, I hadn't planned, but this is an irresistible impulse. I want to share a story from a coaching client about how this can work. I was working with a guy who had founded a company, amazingly successful, doing all kinds of things in executive coaching, and he said one day, "Dave, I want to do something with you if you'll do it with me. I can't stop smoking. I've been to 4 programs, 2 inpatient programs, and 2 residential programs, and I've always returned to smoke. Can you help me?" I said, "Well, let's look at it." I'll call him Art. I said, "Art, when you get an urge to smoke, or when you decide to get a cigarette, what do you do?" He said, "Well, I go get a cigarette." I said, "No, literally, what do you do?" Now, I happen to know that his office complex, where, people came to, was sort of out in the middle of nowhere. And he had built this amazing complex, and it wasn't close to any 7-Eleven stores, basically, the bottom line is here. So he said, "Well, I go to my desk and get a cigarette." I said, "Where is the cigarette?" He said, "Well, the top left drawer." And I said, "How'd it get there?" He said, "Well, I buy it when I go into town." I said, "Art, when you're ready to stop smoking, you will no longer buy cigarettes to have them there, and you won't bum a cigarette off of anyone so that it simply won't be an option anymore." This is a kind of pre-commitment, although I didn't use that word. "When you're ready," he said, "Well, I'm ready now." I said, "Okay, then give me a progress note." I said, "Let me tell you a story about someone I know quite well who was addicted to one thing in his life ever, and that was Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries. And his daughter in high school gave him a box because she knew how much he loved them. They would fight over the dark and the white. And it was fun. And of course, the story is about me, and you may have seen a blog that I wrote some time ago about this. And I decided when she left for college, well, this will be a great way to memorialize her. I'll just get some chocolate-covered cherries, but I know I can't do that through the week. I'll just keep them at my ranch. Now, okay, they were there, and I said, okay, well, okay, I hear them talking to me. I'll only have two a day. They never stopped calling me. I could not get them. So I finally decided, okay, the best way to do it is to not have them there. If they're not there, it's not an option. I waste no energy. So it's been 22 years since I've had a Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherry. And he said, okay, Dave, I'm down. And it was the first time in his adult life that he stopped smoking, and he's continued to sustain his abstinence since. So that's something that not just commitment, but pre-commitment can do, because you have to take away the options. It's not just like planning to work out and you do it at 2 o'clock, but it's taking away the options. So you've probably worked with clients with commitment devices, like a commitment device is making a good decision once, like deciding to automatically transfer X amount of money from your checking to your retirement fund every month. One decision, you don't have to do it every time, you don't have to revisit it. One good decision can make a major difference for the future. You know, I'm sure familiar with that. Some alcoholics take antabuse. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for 3 papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at the chance and did that. Well, what's unstated is 100% of every college student has the opportunity to do it before the deadline instead of squeezing themselves into what they see as an external framework. So these are the things that can be useful to sort of engineer effectiveness. So these are some additional things that I think can help you with clients engineer effective change. And these, again, all focus on the mind-brain aspects of creating a system, which doesn't really have to do with mind or brain, but it's simply a way to be more effective. So, this is in your outline. A few things. Focus specifically on the next step. Now, you guys know this. Some of you have heard me say this story. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope, a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He averaged 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was asked in an interview immediately when he finished how he kept going when he was exhausted and knew he had thousands of miles ahead. And his response, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. Now, he happened to know where the telephone poles ended, 3,339 miles away, but that was a model of shrinking the change to the next step. It's kind of like when you sit down to write a book. Nobody ever sits down to write a book, but if you sit down to write 250 words, well, if you do that every day for a year, guess what? You have a rough draft of 365 pages. 2, specify the next step. And this is so simple. This is not mind or brain stuff. This is fundamental, not abstract, not global. Sum is not a number. Soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. Make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are, where you're going, to measure progress along the way, because a map helps you do that, but it also helps you determine what's detour and what's distraction. Make progress measurable, a specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step, measurable progress, metrics, and to make progress visible, small, specific, attainable milestones that are visible and to celebrate each small victory. Remember, the reason that we do what we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. So imagine this writer who sits down to write a novel or a book. Well, 364 days later, there have been 364 failures. But if you sit down to write 250 words, every day can be a success. And guess who's going to stick with it longer? And one of the classic examples of shrinking a task to make a tangible next step is AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. One day at a time, it shrinks it to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. And a small target leads to small victories. The cumulative experience of effectiveness, the most basic and fundamental desire that we have as humans, effectiveness, leading to the experience of mastery. So this is the scientific method: to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change. The scientific method is a challenge. To create a mindset of inquiry can generate discomfort, but it also catalyzes growth. So here are some considerations in terms of choice enhancement that can apply to incorporating emotions into choice. Increased tension produces emotional regression. So this is an indication to get grounded and centered, and to then reconsider in a balanced state, because an emotion can preempt overriding by the right brain, which can actually hijack and hold hostage the logical left brain. And again, I'm being too simplistic here, but the principle is to make decisions from a balanced position, right and left brain, grounded and centered. And increased emotion can also narrow perspective, because this can cause someone to abandon reason and logic, or can, for someone who's so inclined to go only with reason and logic and leave out emotion, the balanced decisions are ones that are better. So in any state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings, to get grounded and centered, and to address consideration in a self-reflective way from an optimum state of mind. That's a huge aspect of what we do and what we help clients do. Now, I want to talk just a moment or two about choice architecture. This is something that I think is so important in coaching, because this is actually what we do with a client in focusing on the present moment, not on problems, not on the past, not on why, but in this present moment, to consider the choice architecture of what's the next best thing to do. I mean, when you think about it, that's all we ever have to do in life is the next best thing. So the choice architecture is our specific focus in coaching, to collaboratively consider what's the next best thing and how that fits into an overarching picture of goals and that sort of thing. But remember, as we've talked repeatedly, having goals is there's nothing magical about that, because everybody has the same goals. But if you want to change, if you want to create a new habit or change a habit, focus on the system. Now, here's an example of how choice architecture can make a difference, and then I want to talk about framing, because that's what we do. This is, framing is our bread and butter. So I want to return to that in just a second. But here's an example of choice architecture. It's a study at a local car wash that ran, and these are pre-COVID days, obviously, that ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Each time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card. When they filled their card with 8 stamps, they got a free car wash. Now, another set of customers, same car wash, got a loyalty card. They needed to collect 10 stamps rather than 8 to get a free car wash, but they were given a head start because 2 were already pre-stamped. So in other words, both groups were exactly the same. Both needed 8 new car washes to get a free car. But the psychology and the motivation was different. Those who had, as they saw it, a head start with 2 stamps, they were already 20% of the way to the goal. So the results were in after studying a large number of people. 19% of the 8-stamp customers earned a free car wash. Over 34% of the Head Start group earned a free car wash, almost twice as many. And it was exactly the same. They both had to do 8 car washes. So whenever someone is motivated to be partly finished with a longer task or journey, rather than just beginning a shorter one, they're already on the way. So to motivate action would be to frame the task to help people feel they're closer to the finish line. This is an example, I believe, of what I'm referring to in terms of working with clients, that we want to help them develop this self-capacity to reflect and frame the progress they're making, to recognize every step along the way, because this becomes a self-function, and this becomes internally motivating, just like twice as many people wash their cars. And this can be useful in terms of how we frame things. Let me give you some other examples and some ideas about this in terms of framing and the difference that it can make in coaching. So first, consider this question. I'd like you, or this statement, I'd like you to not think about an elephant. Okay, now what happens when I say don't think of an elephant? Well, that statement is the title of a book by a prominent social psychologist named George Lakoff. It ensures that you're going to think about an elephant. Think about how our unconscious, how our midbrain does not know the difference between positive and negative, just the focus. So we get what we focus on. So you want to be sure that you focus on the right thing, not just avoidance of the negative. So whether the focus is negative or positive, it activates the imagery of an elephant. Neuroscience and quantum physics shows us that we get what we focus on, not what we want. So this is important in terms of how we think about framing things. Remember, we talked about how you frame the experience of the brain activation of anxiety and excitement. The brain activates in exactly the same way. Can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. If it's labeled as anxiety, then better head for cover, you look at avoidance, you look at protection. If it's labeled as excitement, as opportunity, as challenge, then you look at positive ways to do it. So this is why I believe, and this question came up and I wanted to answer it out loud here. This is why I believe it's important, at least in my style, to ask for permission to interrupt a client, because as soon as they start with something negative or about a problem or why something can't work, I want to interrupt, because that will only etch that pathway further in the brain each time they do it. So I want to interrupt with what would be more adaptive. What's the possibility? Or I understand the challenge. Let's look at what possibilities there may be that could be beneficial. So this reframing can be useful. This is the basis, actually, of self-directed neuroplasticity. This is something that I think is immensely useful for us in coaching, because what self-directed Neuroplasticity means we simply change our brain by how we address something. Whenever we have a regularly recurring issue, something negative that comes up, simply look at it as an error message from your brain. You're going to have negative self-talk. You're going to have the same kind of things that come up there. I can't do this. I don't know if I may. You know, all the negative self-talk. Think of the last negative self-talk that you heard from yourself. And think about how that's recurred. You're accustomed to hearing that. You're accustomed to hearing that because as soon as you stop yourself from the excitement or the possibility of moving ahead, then that instant state change moves to the negative self-talk. The negative self-talk doesn't cause it. It's the result. So if you treat this self-directed neuroplasticity, if you recognize the self-talk as an error message from your brain because your brain's become accustomed to responding in that way, then to reframe it in terms of the possibility of what's the next step and refocus. So those are three very simple ways to deal with negative self-talk. And all the kinds of ways that you may stop yourself and look at as obstacles. Any obstacle is not there until you create it. So if you look at what's the flip side of every obstacle? A desire. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire, because what you really want, if you stop yourself because it generates anxiety or you're uncertain or you're afraid, then the obstacle seems to be there and we treat it as if it's a noun, as if it's something that's there to be overridden or obliterated or strategized around, rather than simply, this is a creation of this moment. What's the desire? What would it be like if you didn't create the obstacle and instead created a desire? This is a cartoon from some time ago. The first frame of the cartoon shows this dog barking ferociously at a cat. Just let me at him. And then the next frame we see the cat, and this is a reiteration. You guys have heard this before. The cat looks at least as big and ferocious as the dog, and the dog is still barking for us, straining at its leash, and then suddenly the leash snaps, so the dog is totally free to go after the cat. The dog looks back horrified, scared to death, runs back, ties a triple knot, and again strains at its leash. As long as the obstacle is in place, we're free to have the desire, which is the reason for an obstacle. So consider, instead of using the energy to construct an obstacle, look at what it would be like to create and pursue the desire. So here are some other examples of labeling that I think can be important. One is the whole area of conversational intelligence. The first few words of a conversation boot up a particular mindset in the listener or the reader. If those first few words are engaging, positive, collaborative, as we do in coaching, then it boots up the mindset, most likely, of oxytocin mediation, collaboration, connection, bonding. If those first few words are perceived as judgmental or critical, then it boosts up a whole mindset that's mediated by an entirely different neurochemical system that's based on protection and trust and guardedness. So this is a very simple example. Is if you say, if someone asks you to do something and you say no and you feel guilty about it, think about how that's going to boot up an entirely different mindset based on guilt than if you regard it and frame it as, well, no simply means no. It means thank you for the invitation, but I have other commitments, and I really won't be able to do that now. Two totally different mindsets just based on how you label a word, whether guilt's attached or whether self-care is attached. Now, this same notion of framing, whether it's conversation, conversational intelligence, or labeling, or focus, don't think of an elephant, applies to growth mindset. How you label something. Tony Smith, when he coached a national rugby team for the first time, he lost the first 15 games. Now, after every practice and every game, he looked, instead of defeat and pessimism, at what one or two things could be improved, and looked at progress and moving ahead, at deliberate practice and the principles of deliberate practice. He became one of the greatest rugby coaches in the history of Europe in doing it. So this is exactly what we engage in a regular way in coaching, to look at how we can help someone to move ahead, and to move ahead in particular ways that are aligned with their own identity, their own needs and values. So this is where also, and I know if anybody's scrambling to find where I am in the outline, I'm not, because these are some things that I wanted to share with you that I think are important. The outline hopefully speaks for itself, but one thing that I think is so important in terms of identity, because we always want to know how and who a person is and what they do. There's a white paper that I have on my website called Toward Mind Hardware Optimization that incorporates two or three aspects of how we can become more empathically attuned with someone by knowing their personality style, their work and performance styles, and some various aspects of that. But fundamentally, what we want to know is, what are someone's needs and ideals? And that would include their purpose. Now, purpose, what is someone's purpose? What are they really up to? What are they, not just what do they want out of this coaching session, but what do they want out of our coaching engagement, and how does that fit into the purpose of what they really want to do in their life? Let me tell you just a brief story. And this one has some sort of personal meaning. Meb Kaflinsky, in 2014, became the first American to win the Boston Marathon in over 30 years. His win occurred 1 year after the terrorist bombing in the 2013 race. Kaflinsky credits his performance to inspiration he felt for those who died in the terrorist attack the year before. He wrote their names on his race bib so that he could run with greater purpose and motivation. And he put it this way: toward the end, I was remembering the victims who passed away. They helped carry me through. The value placed on what is being learned contributes significantly to learning. We have to care about what we learn, as well as have to fit it with our own ideals of meaning and purpose and our identity. The highest perceived value is that which aligns with our own identity. Purpose can become an orienting perspective to serve as a magnetic pull, and it becomes like an internal compass. When your purpose is for something greater, for yourself or for others, this enhances the likelihood of pushing on. And this has special significance, if you'll indulge me for just a moment. I joined my daughter to run in the Boston Marathon the year before. And the year of the bombing, we didn't run because she was pregnant with my granddaughter, who was named for a combination of my two grandmother, her two great-grandmothers. And every year since then, we've done that. So this had a special significance, and it's like, wow, the same time the bomb went off was very, very close to the time that we both crossed the finish line. So it had some real significance. So let's look. I want to keep your questions in mind, because I want to wrap up a little earlier than I had planned to be sure that we cover the things that are of interest to you. One of the things that I wanted to add, and this is also not in your outline, about how in learning something, and with your clients in learning something, what's the role of unlearning? When we unlearn the connections and associations that are already there, there's another chemical process that occurs that kind of weakens the connections among neurons. It's a form of neuroplasticity, just in the opposite direction of forward learning. So this is important, because every time we repeat something, including looking at a problem or going into a problem to figure out why, it etches it further in our brain. When we create a new way of looking at and addressing something, then we engage in this neuroplasticity going forward to create new ways of looking, considering, and how that in itself becomes activating. So here's what learning research tells us about optimum approaches to combine learning and unlearning, because I think this has a role in work we do with clients every day. So begin with a focused question to activate attention and stimulate the brain to attend to what's next. We do that. We begin with questions, because when you begin with facts or information, a very different process occurs. Think the prototype is, if you have or have been around an adolescent, think about an adolescent. You tell the adolescent information or what to do or what you want them to do. I know where I'm putting my money. It's going to be the opposite of that, because you don't engage that person, because as soon as you, and this is what I teach pro and college coaches about working with players, do not begin with instruction, because when you begin with instruction or facts or information, for the initial response, somebody is going to see if they agree or disagree. If they disagree, they're going to be thinking about reasons they disagree. But either way, you don't have an engaged collaborative. Begin with a question. If you begin with a question, think about this in every presentation that you're going to do. Begin with a question. It engages somebody to think along with you. Whatever is new, different, or even surprises energizes and captures attention. And even if somebody is addressing an uninspiring old topic, change something about it. Even if it's the setting or the application or the framing, anything to notify the brain of something new or different that will enhance attention and productivity. Don't start with a review or a summary of what's happened before. Our brains minimize or even ignore information that's old news. It's a definite way to close things off. Frame the new learning as possibility rather than problem, keeping in mind that it's the problem that has to be unlearned, so it's not what you want to engage and give energy and attention to. Encourage collaborative discussion and involvement. We learn and recall more when we're challenged, when we're engaged, when we're doing things together. This is the basic prototype, the basic framework of everything we do, in my view, in coaching. It's the collaborative model. Every other professional engagement, every other profession has a consultative model. We have a collaborative model. Shrink the change to the next small step and for each aspect of new behavior, what's the next small step? We may want to think about multiple modalities in learning to involve more parts of the brain and enhance learning and memory. Look at that article. It's a short white paper on the brain that I mentioned at my website. It's under the articles tab because it's different perspectives that each may be helpful in empathically resonating and understanding a client and their system and their styles and ways of doing things. If reversion to an old habit recurs, interrupt immediately and reestablish the new focus of the behavior, including for negative self-talk, reasons that it can't work, interrupt immediately. It's not going to help to go down on that old pathway. It'll just etch it further. Remember that an immensely effective means of creating an emotional connection as well as establishing a memory is through stories. And many of you have heard this story. One of the first things I did when I made my transition to professional coaching was to have a storyteller as a mentor. And one of the things he told me was when he passed, he did presentations and that sort of thing. When he passed through O'Hare on one trip, he was stopped by somebody who recognized him, and she just wanted to express her appreciation of how impactful he had been. She said, "You know, I just always remember the presentation you gave." And he said, "Would you remind me what I talked about?" And she said, "Oh, I don't remember what you talked about, but I'll always remember that story you told." And this is an important conclusion, and I want to end here so that we'll have some time to discuss, including our additional time. But all learning is an emotional process and will become optimized with emotional integration. So everything that we do that's meaningful, that would be remembered, integrates emotion and intellect, right and left brain, all levels of brain activity. So if you'll manage the background noise, I'm going to go on discussion mode and see what you think and see what kind of questions you have and if there's more that you'd like me to discuss. So what you got? Questions, thoughts?
Excuse me, Dr. Dave, this is Sherry.
Yeah, hey, welcome.
Thank you. I wanted to just address the fact that the population of women that I am looking to work with has a serious issue with beliefs driving behavior. And you talked about the necessity of revising your identity. And these women either don't have identity, or the identity that they have learned from the individual who has been controlling using them is a very negative identity. Pretty much no value, no self-worth. So what is the best way to begin to approach these issues in order to begin and maintain a better or more positive belief system, and then an identity that follows?
Okay, that's a powerful issue and a very important one. And let me preface it by a couple of comments. One is that we all have identities. That's the cumulative experience of how and who we are. It's our operating system, and we all have operating systems. And for basically almost everyone, most of that, up to 90 to 95%, is unconscious. So The operating system is there. It may be a cumulative set of experiences and beliefs from what's happened before, from how someone has been regarded, how they've looked into the mirror of parents, maybe from early on, and seen instead of an accurate mirror, a funhouse mirror, or only parts of them reflected back. So everyone has an operating system, and that's part of their identity. So what we know now, and this is important in coaching, whenever we have an idea, a belief, anything that we think, believe, and experience, it's an anatomical reality in our brain. That's why education, information, instruction is not going to work, because somebody is just going to see that it doesn't fit with what they really experience. So we have to engage someone and get them to begin to be curious with us at looking at something new. And this is why I emphasize to begin with a question, a collaboration, a story, not with facts or information, because facts or information has never changed anybody. It's never sold one single widget. It's how you engage. So when you engage someone to look at the possibility, to look at what can be learned about what's possible, what they would like to do, to engage that aspect rather than getting back into that old story, because that's not going to change. Whenever they get back into that part of their brain, every time they do, even to resolve a problem, it's going to etch it further. So we're not in the business of solving problems. We're not in the business of understanding the origins of problems, of feelings that go into the development of problems or what happened in the past. The choice architecture that we focus on in coaching is this moment and the choice of this moment, and then what's next and what's after what's next. Remember the study that I mentioned about Ben Fletcher of the University of Hertfordshire? The people came to recognize that every bite they took was a choice. So they began to ask, what's in my best interest? That's how they lost on average 11 pounds without this being a study of diet or food or weight or eating, because they became aware of choice architecture. They didn't go into what's known, what's the default mode, what's the problem, explaining it. The most common thing is, as we've discussed before, the most common thing that we are all addicted to is problems. Because think about how often when you begin a discussion with, let's say, a buddy, how almost from the beginning you go into problems, because that's what creates a kind of relief, because we know how it's going to turn out. We know exactly how it's going to turn out. The hope, maybe without even being conscious of it, is that, well, talking about it one more time will be kind of a catharsis, and here I'll have somebody to commiserate with, and kind of a sort of unity, and induced empathy with someone. But that's what's important to look at with someone, and to actively look, proactively look at now and next with each person, recognizing that understanding the problem is not a compassionate thing to do. We need, and so the key here in terms of what's our method, state always comes before strategy and story. We may want to empathically resonate with someone. I hear how overwhelming that is. Let's look at what can be done as a first step, or what the plan is overall about where you'd like to get to with this. You want to empathically resonate first. State always comes first, because that's how, remember when we drew the circle and the stick figure? That's how you get in that circle, because outside the circle, nobody's going to listen to you. Once you get inside the circle and empathically resonate with somebody, then you can go someplace new together. Mm-hmm. That's also the key for neuromarketing, by the way, because that stick figure in a different universe is your customer. So that's That's a coming attraction next year for for neuromarketing. But for right now, it's what we want to do to resonate with somebody so that we can go someplace new together. Because the unlearning is not going back into the old story and creating something new step by step, shrinking the change to the next right now and the next step, and doing it together in that collaborative model.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I would like to comment in reference to the, and I apologize for taking the time, on the exercising.
Yeah.
Because it depends on the exercise that you choose to do for your body. And I choose the Pilates Reformer. And I don't do it 3 times a week. I do it every day.
Okay.
And when I became sick back in October, I had to stop because I was not well. And I have yet to go back to being able to do that. And I find it very interesting that my body and my mind and brain yearn for the time that I spend, maybe 15, 20 minutes every morning, to get back on the equipment.
Okay, let me expand on that for just a moment, and then I'm gonna, I promise to share the Darren Brown experience. See, I think that's something also that becomes, once you do it, it becomes part of an identity. And as we've discussed just briefly before, you don't have to be motivated to do something. You know, I work with pro athletes and actors. They're not motivated to go to the gym, as I've mentioned, every day, but they do it because they know they need to do it in order to do what's next. I'm not motivated to work out every afternoon, but I do it because it's part of my structure. Now, that's been incorporated because, as we just heard, if I don't do it, I kind of defile my identity. That's not who I am to not work out. It doesn't feel right, basically.
Right.
So that's how identity is incorporated. If I were to buy some random car, it would not feel right. So here's the Darren Brown study, because I think it illustrates a kind of framework in a different direction. Darren Brown did an experiment in the UK in London on Regent Street, which has a lot of pedestrian traffic, or at least did. Darren placed his wallet with money clearly sticking out on the sidewalk. Then he drew a circle with yellow chalk around the wallet, kind of like the crime scenes you see on TV. Then he walked away, leaving the wallet just lying there. Hundreds of people walked past this wallet. Most saw it. Many stopped to look at it, saw the money, but not a single person picked it up. The yellow chalk circle seemed to be a barrier that people were reluctant to cross. The yellow chalk circle was the assumption that limited people from simply picking up the wallet. So the question: what is your yellow chalk circle? And the hint is, it's any assumption that limits you. So, we're obviously in discussion mode. We're past the top of the hour. What kind of thoughts or questions, things would you like to talk about? What else? Anything else that would be helpful to you?
Hello, Dave. It's Monica Hollis. I have a question for you.
Hey, welcome. Yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, so you gave that example about the car wash. So they had the car, and they already had 2 on there, and so they had 8 more to go. And for whatever reason in their mind, they felt like they were closer to it. I get that example, and I get it how the other one, they had 8 to do completely, so they didn't do it as often. But I'm trying to relate that to coaching, though. Can you give us maybe an example of that, like for us?
Yeah. What we know in performance science is that seemingly someone gets a bit more motivated as they get closer to the finish line. So what we can do in coaching and what I think about doing regularly is that every time someone makes progress, to highlight it, because this is what I hope will help them, but it's also what I know they're downloading to be able to self-reflect and do that themselves. And, you know, and that's, you know, sort of step by step. From a slightly different, from a midfield perspective here, it's useful, I think, sometimes to look at a process with a client, to look at where they've been, where they are, and where they want to go. You know, an example, in not just in terms of their goals and maybe, you know, a halfway point or whatever, but just I commented to someone when she said, I'm really making some progress. I said, you know, I want to reflect on that because I realize how not careful I am. I'm saying and interacting with you after a couple of sessions like I would with somebody I'd been working with 2 or 3 months. I just want to highlight how open and receptive you are and how collaborative this is because I feel like I can get away with saying whatever I need to say to you. And sometimes I got to really work to get there. So it validates that someone is participant, that they're engaging in a full-fledged way. Because, I mean, think about that process. What we need to be able to do as mentor coaches is to create the kind of working alliance that we can get away with saying whatever we need to say because the most important things are most likely going to become manifest in the process, not in terms of the content. The content's easy. You can do that in, you know, by week 7 of your CTA course. You know, look at the goals and specify the steps and all. But the real challenge, where we really earn our money, is where the issues come alive in the process of the work, where the attachment and emotional patterns come alive, where we have to work at not taking it personally to be able to really engage someone to look at and reflect on what they're doing. And you saw the summary, I think it's still at the end of the outline. The first bullet is put your ego on a blind trust. In other words, this is all about the client. Don't take it personally. Know that they're going to do everything possible, as they should, to show us exactly what it's like to be them. Because that's what we can then engage that will be most helpful to them because it's aspects that may not be working optimally that they're going to show us as well, or blind spots or biases that are unconscious. And you know, blind spots by definition are ones that you don't see. So all the kinds of things that are unconscious that become manifest, inattention blindness, various kinds of conscious and unconscious biases, all of these operating styles, attachment patterns, all of these are things that will come alive in the work that we can help someone optimally engage with himself or herself first and then with other people. So these are all things that become operative in the domain of what we do in coaching. Thoughts, questions?
It's Sherry again, and I apologize for taking. Jesus.
Well, I didn't hear anybody else run into the mic, so go ahead.
I noticed that you use very specific language, somewhat different than I've read in a lot of other coaching manuals and books and things like that. For example, you use the word collaborative as opposed to any possible synonym. And it would appear that the language is very important and makes a big difference when you work with a client.
What?
Okay. Can you sharpen that into a question? I'm not. It's not the language, it's the model that I'm referring to. The model is one of collaboration because that's the way we do things and what we do together. So it's just the language may reflect that, but it's really the process of us doing it together. We're in the same foxhole looking out on the scene together, not on two sides. But can you sharpen that question if there's one left after I said that?
Well, you're searching or using specific words to produce a mental image instead of using another word like partnership or guide.
Okay.
Is that what you're saying? Specific word such as collaborator.
Oh my God.
Okay, is there a question there? Because I'm not quite getting it.
I just think it's an observation that I made, and I apologize if I'm offending someone in the group.
No, I think it's the essence of the model that we use, and it's an illustration of what I would do in terms of working with somebody. You know, to ask them, for example, instead of a pointed question that they may feel they have to explain, you know, how can we understand this? You know, what we're looking at this together, and I want to understand it together, instead of them taking it as if it's pejorative or judgmental or collaborative, because remember...
I'm getting off and now a chick is annoying me.
Just a second. Hold on. If you have an open mic, so everything's being picked up. So if you would mute, please. This is the essence of conversational intelligence, that how we engage someone will cause a certain mindset to be evoked, and the mindset that I believe is most useful in coaching is one of collaboration.
Okay, that's what I was trying.
Yeah.
I apologize.
Okay. Other questions or thoughts or things that you'd like to? We've got maybe 2 or 3 minutes. Left other things you'd like to talk about?
Yes, Dr. Day?
Yes.
Hello, this is Janina. First of all, I really enjoyed your course. I've learned so much. Could I just ask you, in terms of coaching, I'm having a problem with the clients who aren't actually taking action. The plan is made, but they are not taking those steps. And I'm having a hard time helping them in that. So could you maybe guide me a little?
Okay. First, I would say give it back to them. They need to be having a hard time if they're not doing it and not following through instead of you. So here's how I would think about it. As you end a coaching session with the destination the client had in mind to begin with, because that's a success map you've created, and from that, if you ask the client to summarize in a brief sentence what they're taking away from this session and what they commit to do based on that before you meet again. And if there's anything you write down during the session with that client, it would be if they list 2 things they're going to do, write those down. Then
yes.
When they engage you the next week, call you again, that's where you begin. You ask them, bring me up to date. And if they start off somewhat, let's talk about the 2 things you committed to do.
Yes.
And if they didn't do them, that's what the session is about. Why start all over and plan something else they're not going to do? So I want to know about if they made a commitment to do something. I want to know 2 things. I want to know at the moment they decided they're not going to do it. First of all, I want to know if they had a plan. And I'm assuming because they've worked with me before, they have a specific plan knowing what to do next, because that's the most common thing that looks like resistance or failure to follow through is they don't know what the next step is. So let's assume they have a plan. Let's assume it's structured and simple. And now, wait, do you want to talk or you say something else?
Oh, no, sorry, sir. I was just saying that, yes, in this case,
okay.
There was a plan.
All right. So then if they have a plan, then I want to know what their conversation was internally the instant they decided they're not going to follow through on the plan. So you know they have a plan, and they said no to that plan, or they decided not to follow through. I want to know what the immediate internal conversation was, the frame, right before they said no. Was it, well, the hell with it, I'm going to have a good time? Or did they bargain with themselves to say, well, I'm going to do it next Tuesday? Or did they get scattered and not know? In other words, what happened the instant before they decided not to follow through, because that's what I want to address? Now, if that frame right before they decided not to follow through was from a different perspective. Here, remember when we talked about the two most basic motivations we have as humans is desire to avoid pain, to seek pleasure. If there's some shadow story, remember we talked about this in the first seminar, if there's a shadow story that goes the opposite direction of their stated goal, like the shadow story may say, well, you know, I'm afraid if I really put myself out there, then I'd fail and I'd look really bad, or I'd really be embarrassed, or I don't think I have what it takes. In other words, I want to know if there's some pain they're avoiding, because it can look like sabotage, but from an adaptive perspective, they're simply avoiding the pain of some embarrassment or failure or something else, so that we can frame it from a coaching perspective of what's the greater pain if you don't proceed? And what's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? So it takes into account those two basic motivations, but reframes it in terms of coaching for what's next. Does that make sense in terms of your question?
Yes, thank you very
okay.
much.
Well, we're over what I said. I really appreciate and value all of your input. Thanks for the interaction, everything you sent me. I hope this was helpful, and I totally enjoyed putting this together and interacting with you. It's been my privilege, and, well, I hope we're not done. If there's any way I can be of help to you, let me know. Have a great holiday season and a super new year. Take good care of yourselves, and thanks again for
all of your
participation.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you.